the basketball.
Blog Talk Radio.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball. They're playing basketball.
Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, are they still playing basketball?
Oh, yes, Don. We're still a couple weeks before the big Monday night national game, if you will. Yeah. In fact, we're just moving into what is called the Sweet 16. That'll be the 16 remaining teams. So, yeah, a lot of basketball to be played. Why? What's up?
Well, no, I was just wondering because I played the basketball song and I thought to myself in the studio, I mean, he was looking at me because I had this crazy look on my face. I said, I wonder if the basketball stuff is over yet.
Yeah, we've got at least 3 more weeks to go. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even follow it, so that's right. Next time I should ask you in a production meeting. Edwards, we got a big show tonight. We're also happy to have, we want to kick off at the beginning of the show, we're happy to have a candidate for Senate running against the incumbent. Senator Champion, we have with us Pat Wynn Lawrence, the former chairman, the multi-term chairman of the Council for Black Minnesotans, when it was named the Council for Black Minnesotans. Mr. Lawrence, welcome.
Well, good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Good evening. Okay, I thought I had a delay going there. So you made your announcement earlier in the week. I mean, it's Wednesday. I think it was, Monday or Tuesday, you made your announcement. It went out, went viral. A lot of people are checking you out. First question, and I have a series of questions because I want to not only test your knowledge of the seat, but also check on your moral compass for this particular position. But the first question, I guess, what made you decide to run against someone so embedded like Senator Champion?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Well, the reason why I'm running is because, you know, as a U.S. citizen and as someone that has resided here in Minnesota for a number of years, you know, I meet the eligibility requirements. And that's really the main requirement that somebody should look at when they're considering running for office. They shouldn't let what somebody else has, whether they are an attorney or whether they've had many years in certain offices, but they should look at it and say, well, do I meet those qualifications? And if so, what can I bring to the table? And my work with the Council on Black Minnesotans for 4 years, I was appointed by Governor Dayton in 2011, served for 4 years. 3 of those years, I was the board chair. We did a lot of great things, you know, under my leadership as chair of the council. And so I looked at the district that I lived in, because being in that position, it was a statewide organization, so we had statewide visibility. We got to go around the state and talk to different communities, so I got to hear a lot of the issues that are going on around the state. But my particular district I live in, District 59, which is North Minneapolis and downtown Minneapolis, which, you know, Bobby Joe Champion is the current incumbent, there's just serious systemic problems that have been going on for years. And he has been in that seat for a number of years, and things have gotten increasingly worse year after year. Ideas have been presented to him year after year, especially from the council. So, and what's interesting about this, just over the past year, it seems like, oh, now there's a movement towards wanting to take some sort of action. Well, that's only happening because it's an election year. They want to shore up the vote for the Democratic Party, which I am running for the DFL endorsement as a DFL candidate. But, you know, they should not be playing these kinds of games with the lives of their constituency, because a lot of those ideas that they're bringing forward have come from the council. These ideas that you're hearing about, the governor talks about in his, you know, State of the State speech, things that you're hearing from Champion and some of the other legislators, particularly
yeah,
about
and,
the audit,
and,
all that came out of the council. And so,
yeah, let me cut in there. And we're to get into that, but let me cut in right there,
oh, okay.
Because we're to get into those questions in a minute, and I'm pretty sure Mr. Edwards might have something here
okay.
in a moment. But,
sure.
you know, I want to, you know, there's an American structure of government, and I want
mm-hmm.
you to ask you a question. What is your ideology behind democracy, or what is a democracy?
Well, first of all, a democracy is – as kind of the old adage goes, it's probably one of the worst forms of government you want. We have a constitutional republic, and it's a constitutional republic is what's one of the great things behind the United States. Because if we had a democracy, if, you know, 51% of the people say, well, let's enslave all, you know, Mexicans, then, you know, well, maybe the Mexicans that are here could vote, but they would be over outnumbered and then, you know, go into enslavement. But we have the rule of law. We have laws that we can abide by that actually are supposed to protect the minority group. And I don't mean minority in necessarily racial sense, but the group that is not a part of the majority. And so that's one of the blessings
okay.
about our governance in the United States. So constitutional republic is what Horton vote for.
Okay, to our listeners, he's absolutely correct, because a democracy is a government wherein decisions are made by the masses of people rather
mm-hmm.
than by elected
That's
representatives.
Right.
And then the republic is a system where the laws are passed and made by the elected representatives of the people. So are you saying that you will listen to the people and craft laws or legislation and push it forward on behalf of the people that you represent?
Well, absolutely. So the way that I see the role of a legislator is a public servant, not as an official, even though I know sometimes that's what they're called, but they should have the mindset of a public servant. So you really need to do the will of the people that are electing you into that position. So you need to consult with them. You need to consult with many of them. You need to get them together in convention, if possible, and I think that's the key missing point from what's happening now in the state of Minnesota. Well, we have a governor, Governor Dayton, who I have to applaud that, you know, he's willing to step out there and say we need to correct these issues in terms of racial disparities, but I think that it's being administered improperly, not necessarily by him, but by the legislators. What they should be doing, instead of coming up with ideas themselves, are just going to a small niche group of people, typically those who are going to benefit monetarily from it. They need to open it up to the larger community, especially on these racial disparities. And that way we can solve this problem or set it up to where it can be solved in a number of years by doing it correct the first time. Because what I don't want to happen is for money to then be appropriated, money to go out into the community, and nothing changes. Because people are going to say, well, you know, we spent $100 million on this, you know, in 2016, 2017, but, you know, why are you guys coming back in, you know, 2018 or 2020, and nothing has changed. Things are worse. What, you know, what happened?
Yeah. Yep.
That's what we really
okay.
don't want to happen. So we want to make sure that everybody is at the table that can be possibly at the table, where all ideas are considered, all people who are able-bodied and able to, you know, take up their role as a citizen activist, wanting to see change in their community, has a voice so that it can be rectified correctly the first time. And so
okay,
as
I
a
have
legislator, I would do that.
Okay.
Okay,
I have a couple more questions for you. And if you could, I would like you to answer these yes or no if you can.
Okay.
If you cannot, you need
okay.
to elaborate. Go ahead. But
okay.
just for the sake of us running here, first of all, during your tenure as the chairman of the board of the Council of Black Minnesotans, did you ever or have you ever sat on a MnDOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, advisory or oversight committee?
No.
Okay, thank you. During mm-hmm. your tenure as chairman of the board of the Council of Black Minnesotans, Have you ever sat on a oversight or advisory committee for a baseball stadium, football stadium, or the Target Center?
No, I have not.
And then one from our listeners. Do you have any children out of wedlock?
No, I do not. Even though I want children, but I don't have any of this time.
Yeah, well, it is. Okay, I'm going to say that. Anyway, well, sounds good. Mr. Edwards, any questions for Mr. Pat?
No, continue on, Don. You seem to have a list of questions there. Just continue on. I'll chime in.
Okay. Here's what I want to ask you. You and I both, and we know this because of my affiliation with the council for years, have read the 2015 legislative agenda that was put together by yourself, the board, and Mr. Edward McDonald. And it was detailed. And it seems to me, Mr. Lawrence, that folks have gotten a hold of that and ripped it apart and picked a section that they could comprehend and ran to the governor with it. What do you think the success of this piecemealing is going to do to the community? You had just said something about let's not go back when we get to 2020, but as you know, and as you know, Mr. Edwards and some of our listeners know, you know, they'll have a new model of a Mercedes out in 2020. So, you know, someone might need to go get one. But I guess my question is, what is this just a knee-jerk reaction by Governor Dayton? I mean, is $100 million enough to kill the generational disparities that have went on, or do we need to deal with the people at the state level that sit behind the desk in human resources, in contract compliance procurement? Because you know the story. I'm sorry, I don't mean to go on, but I need to get this out so you can give me a full answer. You know, in the last 16 years, about $400 million in contract procurement has been kind of flying out the doors, and I guess the goal for the state, for us, minority ethnics, small business, et cetera, was about 8%, and they've never made it to 1%. So who's responsible for that? And you can answer whichever way you want. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I would say I would have to absolutely agree with you. And I don't mind so much that, you know, they've looked through our legislation, not just from last year, but then 2014, where we had, I believe it was 12 bills. I think that year the Pioneer Press, they did an article in January of 2014, where, you know, the first time in the council's history, you know, taking, you know, bills to the legislature. And we had, I believe it was 12 or 13 bills that year. And so we've addressed a lot of the issues that people are coming forward with. We had already addressed in our legislation in previous years and last year. But, you know, I'm not focused on is, you know, pointing fingers and saying, well, I don't think you guys could be successful at doing this. The point is, if they would have involved the community, because that's what we did, that's where ideas came from. Yes, as council members and as the executive director and staff, we input our ideas as well, but mainly this is community driven. This comes from the community, and the legislator's job would be so much easier if they actually just listen to their constituency and actually try to implement their ideas, because the people that are suffering and going through the issues of disparities and discrimination, they know what the solutions are. We just need to listen to them, let their voices be heard, and implement the solutions. And so I don't think that they're going to be successful, one, because I believe it's just too sure up votes for the Democratic Party. You know, when you look at something that they really want to push this session, which is restore the vote, which I think is an honorable thing. If you served your time and you, you know, have paid, made your debt to society, and now that you're free, you should be able to vote again. But the problem is there are people who have never been to prison, that have never had a record, that still can't get jobs because of discrimination and institutional racism that is out there. So that's only a piecemeal or a cosmetic solution. What we need to look at is the larger picture of why are we having these issues in the state of Minnesota, and what those solutions are. The community members have already brought these forward, the council, other organizations. have brought forward solutions. They just need to be implemented in a more cohesive fashion. That's why I say a convention is needed to really get all of these voices together in this particular situation. I know you can't do this on all legislation, but in, for a particular situation like this, the convention is needed to bring people together to see what needs to be done to where we can then finally start to make a huge headway on resolving these racial disparities, because we can't keep having, it seems like month after month or week after week, new studies coming out, new news reports about, you know, Minnesota is such a great place, but then yet they're like, well, that's only for white people, but for everyone else, you know, it's a horrible place to live, and you have all of these disparities, and your children can't read, they can't do basic math, you know, I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah, correct.
And so,
yeah, you're absolutely.
So that's why if the legislators actually listen to their constituency, and that's the main reason why I'm running, is because I feel like they don't listen to their constituency, you know, they play games. You know, the legislators, and I'll share more of this at the convention. I'm trying not to go into all of what I'm going to talk about at the convention, which is on April 2nd, the first Saturday in April, the endorsement convention. But what people need to know is that legislators, they know what the solutions are. They've been listening to people, but they've been hiding it. They've been trying to find a way of how to use it to their advantage, are doing it only in certain years where it benefits them in terms of the election, but then in other years, well, oh, well, too bad. Because we went out and did a request for an audit last year. We were out there in June of last year with the heads of the five heads of the NAACP here in the state of Minnesota. We were in front of the Capitol building, and we were calling for an audit, and an audit would be it would just be hugely successful in terms of the government being able to see where they are lacking in terms of their compliance with, you know, civil rights and equal opportunity laws. And it's not about saying, we got you, now we're going to, you know, do all of these mean, vindictive things. No, this is actually so that you can take corrective action and then be able to then solve it so that it's not a systemic problem,
okay,
and it's not an ongoing problem. Because people are actually, I believe, especially with white citizens, I think they are actually getting fatigued, or probably have already been fatigued about it. It seems like we're always complaining about something. You hear this particularly from conservatives. They say, oh, you guys are always complaining. You're always coming with the same things. And the reason why it seems like people are complaining over and over again, because things are never being addressed. People will talk about it. They might even banner around solutions, but nothing is ever actually effectively implemented. So then that issue is resolved, and then we can go on and resolve larger problems that are, you know, going on in society. So that's what needs to be done. We just need to implement, take
okay.
action, and move forward.
On that note, we've seen reports out of the some public local public policy institutes in Washington, here and in Washington D.C., New York mm-hmm. Times, Washington Post articles that, and even Star Tribune that talked about how not good it is for a large percentage of African Americans. And today I was listening to NPR, which I try to do on a regular basis, you know, even if I don't like them, I listen to them, because there's sometimes there's some piece of information you can, you know, absorb from them. And they had the lady, the executive director of MEN, Minnesota Educational Excellence, something or another. And I don't really get along with those collective impact groups. But she said something that struck me, and it dovetails with what you just said. And what she said was that over 63% of the minorities in Minnesota will not be able to get jobs because they don't have a high school diploma. You know, which means that, you know, there's a high dropout rate that's not being addressed. There's a few other things not being addressed, but since people of color and a lot of white folks here in Minnesota don't think the government works, what would you do to fix the underlying structures and systems that seem to be broken?
Well, what I would do to fix that is I would ensure that we talk to the public, we inform the public, our constituency, of what the real problems are. what the real solutions are, and then trying to find a way to move forward. Because it's not only it's not something that one person can do. I couldn't just do that in and of myself. Nor one legislator could do that. But working together, that can be done. And also with the public, the constituency, holding their legislative members accountable. And really, you know, I'm all for term limits and also having the ability to recall legislators. And that might seem kind of extreme in some cases in terms of having to recall. Really, recall should be during the election cycles, where if that person is not being effective, if they're not doing their role, if, you know, they're not, you know, bringing funds back to the district, then they need to be replaced. That seems to not work because people just keep sending the same folks back expecting something different, and that's a sign of insanity if you keep doing the same thing expecting a different result. So I think to be able to resolve that problem, that comes not just from legislators, but that comes actually from the people, the constituency, holding folks accountable, especially in terms of education. If your kids can't read and write, test scores came out, you know, last year. I mean, that's horrible where – where you were saying 63% cannot read or write. You know,
yeah, don't have diplomas.
But what I was going on is saying that also those test scores showing that, you know, they can't do basic math or read. You know, they build prisons off of those test scores. So we might as well
based
say,
on third grade.
Well, hey, well, yeah, so we might as well just say, well, you know what, we don't need to do any kind of remedy for disparity. We just might as well just start building prisons. Take that $100 million and start building prisons, because apparently we're going to need that. Apparently
they're trying to do that now.
Doing right now. Well, I understand that, but that's where we are. And so people need to wake up to what their legislators have been doing and take action. And I think people are doing that because you see that in the political cycle. You see it on the Republican side. You see it on the Democrat side. You see people waking up, and the system is showing itself. It's showing how they only want certain people in positions. So you see how they – when it's Hillary versus Bernie, you see how Bernie – the coverage is with Bernie – or on the Republican side, whether you like Donald Trump or not, you see how, even though he's their front runner, how people are positioning themselves with him. It shows how the system works, and the public is getting wise to this, and I think this is why this is a perfect time that not only in District 59, but in other districts around the state, that people need to say, we've had enough, things need to change, we really need to take action, because if we don't, then we're really headed into a really, really bad place, not only just because of the test scores and what's coming up with our youth, but then you have to look at the criminal justice issue. You know, we're one shooting away from probably the place going up in flames. What are we doing to actively resolve
now,
that?
I'm going to have to your time is up, sir. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to have to cut you off here for a minute because the last few minutes, I need to give this number
I'm sorry,
out.
I'm
calling number.
Sorry.
That's okay. Our calling number is 347-426-3904. That's 347-426-3904. And we have a caller. Caller, you have a question for candidate Lawrence.
I do have a question for candidate Lawrence. Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Go ahead. I'm Lisa. I'm calling from Minneapolis, North Minneapolis. I'm not sure if you represent my district or not. If you're running against Bobby Joe, I believe you are. But my question in listening to you, and this is very serious when it comes to what's going on in our community, you speak on a lot of the ills that take place in our community. And one thing that I noticed when people come and run during election season, they come into the community and they campaign on the ills of our community. Now, I know you have been with the Council of Black Minnesotans, I'm sure, and I'm aware of that as well. And my question for you is, how successful were you there in making sure you dealt with the disparities in our community? And if you were not successful, how will you be successful as a senator working in a community to deal with those ills that you're campaigning on? Because we have a lot of people that campaign on the ills, but then when they get in office and they get in a seat, we don't see them, we don't hear from them, and corporations have bought them out. So we want to make sure that stops in our community. And that's a serious question, and I want to know, I want you to answer that. Thank you.
All right, Lisa. Yes, Lisa, thank you. That is a fantastic question, and I'm very appreciative of you asking that. The way that you hold your legislators accountable is at the endorsement convention when they're going for reelection or when they're first running. You talk with them. You find out where they are on the issues, where they stand. If they haven't been doing their role in that position, if they're incumbent, you need to vote them out. As I said earlier, the public, they seem to just keep recycling the same people, expecting, maybe they're going to change the session or not. And they've proven over a track record, over a period of time, that they're not. They're just in there for personal gain or for their buddies, bringing money just back to them instead of seeking the betterment of the entire community. So it's really the constituency, they need to hold them accountable. So that's the first part of the answer to your question. Secondly, when I was with the Council on Black Minnesotans, we were successful in the fact that our role is an advisory organization to the governor, the legislature, and state agencies on issues impacting persons of African descent in the state of Minnesota. We were very successful in bringing out those issues and laying them out in a coherent, clarified manner to where people can actually understand what those are. The studies we did in terms of, affirmative action and hiring and procurement, looking at the Human Rights Department and how long it takes for, cases to cycle through there, and look at ways of getting them increased funding so that they can effectively do their job. Looking at the role of the actual council and increasing that funding so that it can be a more effective organization. In the 30-some years that the council has been in existence, until last year, its enabling legislation had not been, had not been touched. It had not been expanded. And so that's one of the things that we looked at doing was to how can we expand the role of the council so it can be a more effective organization. So in the role that we were defined legislatively, we did our job, and we did a fantastic job. What was not liked is the information that we were bringing forward, because we were showing that people in state government, whether it's legislators, the people in those agencies, were not doing their job, and they actually were breaking the law, because these disparities that are going on within our community, if you see these disparities, that means laws are being broken. And so people don't like when you basically are showing them to be criminals, when there could be civil and criminal penalties attached to that. So we were very successful in that in terms of what we can do legislatively. We worked with legislators, but where those bills did not advance was because of our black legislators. It was because of would go and they would talk to legislators and they would tell them not to support our bills. We would actually take our bills to them first, because we actually represent them as the Council on Black Minnesotans. We would actually go to our black legislators first and say, this is what we want to move forward with. Would you carry any of these bills? And you know what? They didn't. They had their own agenda. They really wanted to see the councils do their work for them, in the sense of you come and you work on what we want you to work on. And that's what we now see with the Council on Minnesotans of African Heritage, is now it's going to be a lapdog to the legislators, and that's not how the councils were designed to be. So as a legislator, if I'm elected, what I'm going to be is a public servant to my constituency. I'm not going to be beholden to anyone but my constituency. I'm not a part of the system. I didn't go in there and say, hey, well, I'm just going to become buddies with everyone so I can move up and advance personally. And no, what I want to do is I want to go in there and I want to do the work of the people. And that should be the number one goal of any elected official, is do the work that their constituency tells them to do.
Let me do this now, Mr. Lawrence, because actually, you've been with us for 28 minutes, and there are a couple of questions that I now need to ask you to get the necessary clarification. So let me start like this.
Okay.
Number one, how long have you lived in Minnesota, and how long have you lived in North Minneapolis?
So I have lived in Minnesota for, 13, 14 years, and I have not lived in North Minneapolis. Go there quite a bit, but I have not lived in North Minneapolis.
Well, when you say that you haven't lived in North Minneapolis, your senatorial district comprises North Minneapolis, except for that small part to the south of 394. Is that what we're saying?
The district 59 is all of North Minneapolis, then down to the river, to the Mississippi, all the way
I'm talking about going south. What part of the district do you live in?
Yeah, I'm downtown. So it goes all the way down to 35, and then over to about 12th Street downtown. So that's your boundary, and then to 394.
Well, all right. Let's go back to what I asked you the question. How long have you lived in Minnesota? And I asked the question again. How long have you lived in the senatorial district?
My entire time.
All 13 years you've been
13,
here.
14, yes.
Oh, okay. Now, you pointed out there will be an endorsement convention on the 2nd of April. Now, incumbent champion has been out raising money, having fundraisers, and et cetera, for quite some time. Have you began to raise financing and funding?
No. And because what I'm going to do this, here is I want to make a point actually to the people in the district is it's not about how much funds you raise. It's not about how much you go out there. It's about, one, it's about your message, and two, and it's about your track record. And so, you know, I'm looking at that endorsement convention. I understand that this is going to be a long process. I'm not just looking at that one point in time, which is April 2nd, but I'm looking towards November. And so even, let's say, if a candidate, a new person comes in and they get the endorsement, whether it's me or if it's someone else, Champion, he already has been in that position for a while. He already has the networks
You said that the second time. While is what? How long has he been a senator?
He has been this is his, first term as senator, and then he was two terms as a representative.
He's representative first, then a senator next.
Yeah.
Why I asked you with specifics and detail. He was a representative for how long? Do you remember? Do you know?
I believe he was a representative for 4 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, and he's been a state senator for, is this his second term, third term?
This is his first term, and so he'll be up for reelection.
Okay. Now, we asked the question about fundraising, and you kind of indicated where you thought you were with that. If you do not receive the endorsement, will you continue to seek?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's where I was going with that. Because even though somebody new comes in, because he has already been in that position, has already had the networks and all of that, he can still continue on even if he doesn't receive the endorsement.
If that question is asked from the floor on the 2nd, if you do not receive the endorsement, will you run against the endorsed candidate? Do you feel that could possibly hurt you with loyalty to the party?
Well, see, that's part of the problem. People want to focus on the party. We got to get away from focusing on the party, whether it's Republican or Democrat, we need to focus on the issues. We need to be focused on getting people elected who are going to get in and make some changes, because we can't keep, because of the political situation, we can't let that freeze us into a box where we have to say, we only have this or this.
Let me ask you this question.
No,
yeah, I understand, but I'm asking specific questions, and you'll have every opportunity, clearly, to indicate your philosophy to the to the voters and the constituents.
Sure.
Now, let's say you're elected to the Minnesota Senate. You've indicated a number of things that you'd like to do, you want to do, you expect to be able to do, and change the paradigm, and et cetera. Now, who will you caucus with and who will you work with in the Minnesota Senate? I mean, when I ask that question, I'm talking in terms of what are you looking for in those that you will align yourself with philosophically, politically, and ethically. So what are you looking for?
Well, if I am going to be running as a DFL, then it will be with the DFL. That will be my party. That's who I would caucus with. But then I would also reach out to the Republicans as well, because we have to work across parties.
On what issues? What issues do you see a commonality with regards to the Republicans that you could identify with and support? Give us a couple of indications.
So I kind of want to keep those to myself in terms of waiting for the convention, because there's certain information, because I know people are listening, and I know that, you know, the other side kind of has their, you know, ears listening to see how they can position themselves for the convention. But what I want to say in general is that where I find commonality with the issues of the other side are within my own party, then I'm willing to work and move forward on those issues. And that's what we have to do.
Do you have a couple of names of a couple of current senators that you feel comfortable in identifying with and working with on common issues? Can you give us two?
Well, no, I don't want to give any names, but yes, there's actually several. Some that we've actually, through the council, that we actually were working on legislation with. Actually, there's quite a few on both sides, Democrats and Republicans.
Well, but you're not ready to name them, though. But that's just what you said just now. You want to maintain a certain level of secrecy and confidentiality. I understand that. I certainly agree with that. All right. Is there anything let me ask this question, because you went into quite a kind of a dissertation with regards to those that should have their rights restored. Would you craft legislation which would set some parameters on what would maybe be a prohibition about having their rights restored? I mean, do you think that a person who had committed fraud or a person who was involved with DWI should have the same consideration as a person that's a pedophile, manslaughter? I mean, where do you come down? Everyone who's had a felony, or should there be classifications of those that have a felony and having their rights restored?
Restored, yes. So I believe that if you have served your time, if you were convicted of a crime and you've gone to prison, you've served your time, that once you come out, then you should have your rights restored. Now, you could probably make the argument that, you know, certain, you know, crimes maybe that would stop you from, you know, ever being able to vote again, just like having certain financial crimes would, you know, stop you from being able to hold, you know, certain positions. That, you know, that could be something taken under consideration. But at this current time, I believe that, you know, whatever crime that you have committed, and as long as you've gone and you've served that time, and now that you've done that and you're a free person, you should be able to have your rights restored.
Okay. Let me ask the specific classification on this. And at the same time, I'd like for you to indicate if the council, under your leadership, the 4 years that you were there, three as chairman, as you pointed out, if you ever took a position with respect to what has been a very controversial issue in the state of Minnesota, and that is those who have been convicted of sex crimes, served their time, but were still allowed to be incarcerated. You know, there are currently some cases in the federal court, and et cetera. Did the council ever take any position on that, and what would be your position as a state senator with regards particularly to sex offenders who have technically served the time that was imposed on them by the court, but then a petition has been filed to continue to incarcerate them because of a psychological analysis of their problems? So what is your disposition on that?
Well, the council, under my leadership, we never took a stance on that. When we had our sessions, crafting our legislative agenda, that issue never came up, from what I recall, any of the sessions that we had with the community about what we should move forward with as an organization. So that was not addressed. But my personal opinion on that is that I understand why they would have, you know, psychological, you know, issues around, you know, what got them in prison. And so I think as it relates to, though, restoring their vote and them being able to participate in democracy, or I should say in our voting system, that would not impede them from being able to vote. You know, because they don't have to go to the polls, that we could actually send them the ballot to them. So they still would be able to participate in that sense. But what they're being prohibited from is having contact with, let's say, children or, you know, other vulnerable persons where they might be able to endanger them or endanger themselves. So I don't see those two as related.
Right. Let me ask you one final question.
They can still have their vote.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I think it's important that I say this to you, that you understand that we have an obligation to offer equal time to Senator Champion or anyone else that is a contender. So that
Absolutely.
Hasn't been said by us, but we want our listeners to know that we are quite committed to make sure there's equal time. One final question, and it has to do with the issue that you talked about earlier about recall. And, of course, as you mm-hmm. obviously know, the state of Minnesota does not have a recall constitutional
mm-hmm.
provision. What percentage of voters in the district, either House or Senate, that a person would represent, or in the case of a constitutional officer, such as the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and et cetera, what percentage of the eligible voters in that particular district or in this state would you comfortable with, and would you propose legislation that would have to be involved in a recall? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. The governor of the state of Michigan, we all know
mm-hmm.
his terrible history, is up for recall as we speak. The Constitution of the state of Michigan indicates that 750,000 registered voters must sign a petition to recall him. Starting
mm-hmm.
with the legislative district and then statewide offices, what number do you feel comfortable with constitutionally?
Oh, that's actually a very good question.
Yes, I know it is. That's why I asked. Go ahead.
I know you're very good at that.
Yes, I am.
So could you rephrase it though?
Let me rephrase again.
What
is the percentage
mm-hmm.
of eligible voters in a district, and
mm-hmm.
what would be the percentage of eligible voters in the state? In the case of the district, to recall
mm-hmm.
everybody from a councilman to a mayor to a county commissioner
mm-hmm.
to a representative of the House of Representatives to a state senator to a United States senator to a United
mm-hmm.
States federal representative to the governor and to members of the executive office, what is the percentage of eligible voters that would have to indicate by petition
mm-hmm.
that they are recalling the elected official? Let's just stay with the state office. What number do you need? Are you comfortable with 51%, or what number have you thought about?
I would say around 2/3.
Two-thirds? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would say 66%. This was 67%. Would probably be a good number to start looking at, because what you don't want it to just be 50, because then they might not be happy with, you know, one way you voted, and then somebody, you know, sends in a petition or, you know, goes
uh-huh.
through the process, and it was over, you know, something not necessarily trivial, but not something of the great magnitude of, like, what's going on in Michigan. So I think, you know, for extreme cases where somebody does need to be removed, it would be something to where so high in terms of the constituency being upset and impacted by something that the official did that you would need a high threshold to be able to.
So you're
that
thinking of terms of 2/3, slight 66 percent,
mm-hmm.
and so that's kind of a number you have in the back of your mind, right? Okay, all right.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the time, Mr. Alvin. You want to wrap it up? Mr. Alvin, are you still there?
Hello?
Yes, I am still here.
Okay. Well, we asked three times.
You
disappear
I heard,
on the third time. But go ahead. You want to wrap it up? And thank you again, Mr. Lawrence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
no
I would. And so the reason why I was on the other line talking to someone, because someone just made me aware of Bill HF 2743, which I'm going to paraphrase. If a form of petition, any registered voter may petition requesting a removal of an election and setting forth facts with alleged that an official committed malfeasance or non-malfeasance in the performance of his or her duties. It's HF 2743. Anybody's going to be able to walk with a petition just by that person to get somebody removed for something they don't like saying. But anyway, Patwin Lawrence, we appreciate you being with us. We'll call you later here in the year for an update. Thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing what happens after convention. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Right.
Now, that house file that you came up with there, Don, is that in the state of Minnesota? Is that North Dakota, Montana?
That's the state of Minnesota.
Where is that? Because there is no recall provision in Minnesota.
It's HF 2743, which is being put on the table. Actually, it's been here. It's a bill for an act.
Right. There you go. We didn't clarify that to our – that's not a current statute. That's something being proposed. That kind of – helps Mr. Lawrence out a little bit. Okay, all right. We have any calls holding and et cetera?
No,
I thought that was
holding.
A good call by Lisa Dean. So what else do we have? Because it's a hot time in the old town. I want to repeat that we certainly will be inviting incumbent Senator Bobby Joe Champion and provide equal time at some time. You know, actually, we probably should have done it before the endorsement convention. Maybe he will try to join us next Wednesday. But anyways, what else we got, Don?
Well, you know, we need to talk about education, Mr. Edwards, and what's going on this field, this teacher from the St. Paul Public Schools that put the post on Facebook. I was just trying to look it up, Mr. Edwards. I don't have it right in front of me, but I can definitely paraphrase what it said, and I guess it's in the newspaper, but I'm not going to go to the Star Tribune website to give them any more hits. But the thing is, he asked questions about the prison, the pipeline, and he's concerned about the level of this violence and this behavior in these public schools with these high school students. And Mr. Edwards, on this one, I'm sorry if the listeners get upset with me, but I don't think this white dude was being racist, and I have to back him 100% because, as you know, I'm in the schools, especially St. Paul Public Schools, every day. And I'm going to tell you, Mr. Edwards, some of the things I see I never saw when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, these teenagers, they will what's called punk a white teacher, walk up in their face like they go punch them. I heard one guy turn to a white female in school, says, you know, I just want to punch you in your face.
Wow.
You know, and I'm like, wow. And she was just sitting there. She didn't even get up. She didn't run out. She just sat there terrified. And so I think some, not all the students, but quite a few students. And
Don, let me ask you this question. Why do you think it's so prevalent here in the last couple of years in St. Paul as opposed to Minneapolis? What's your take? You're in the schools, as you pointed out. Why is it so prevalent the last couple of years? I mean, what is happening? Is there less parental control over the students in the St. Paul school system as opposed to Minneapolis? I mean, what do you think is at play here?
I don't think that's it. But I think the problem is not even in the school systems, but we're going to have to look at the communities and society and the historical assumptions and expectations of the school district. Now, the teachers that I run into are really good. From what I could see, and I'm a pretty good judge of character, they seem to want to be in it, but there's this political component. And if you look at some of the stuff that they have to teach the kids, mandated by the Minnesota Department of Education, the Board of Teaching, Pearson, and Scholastica, you know, it's a wonder these kids, you know, aren't jumping out the window. The behavior in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I think, are at the same level. When you get to the high school level, the middle school level is pretty, except for like maybe the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I think is tame. The kindergarten, the K through third grade or fourth, K through fourth grade is looking pretty good. But there are some things going on in society where you see children that don't have in these classrooms. You see children that beeline it to get to school to make sure they can eat. They have several, Mr. Edwards, and I worked in them, locked wards with children that are so severely mentally ill, developmentally challenged, handicapped, that they bounce on balls all day. They can't communicate. They can't talk. They have no sense of vernacular at all whatsoever. And so we're not seeing any of that you know, in the mainstream. And my suggestion would be for some of those senators and state representatives to tour some of these places, seeing it firsthand and seeing how some of these regulations, these rules are choking these teachers, tying these teachers' hands, and not letting them have the opportunity to teach like we were taught when we were in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah. So what do you think the cost will be, though, for this reform? Because you're talking about reform as it pertains to the philosophy of education and the implementation and application of education in America. You think that's going to cost more money, or do you think that the legislature, the Congress, and et cetera will be prepared to provide that money? And by the way, last week there was an announcement by the Teachers Federation that teachers, unfortunately, are leaving the profession, and others who are coming out of college are not choosing education/teaching as their first choice. What is your take on that?
Well, first of all, Mr. Edwards, why would you go to a school like Hamline or the University of Minnesota or St. Kate's or Bethel and get a teaching degree as an undergrad or get your master's degree as a master's student and go work for $26,000?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Why would you put up with that day-to-day, you know, dealing with people, dealing with attitudes, individuals? And, you know, a lot of folks that are graduating from these teaching masters in teaching program, MAT programs, and education undergrad programs, a lot of them are going right into corporate America, being corporate trainers. And the teaching profession does not look attractive right now based on what's going on. But secondly,
now, do you think, Don, that this is an outgrowth of weak negotiating skills amongst the teachers' federations and their leadership?
Well,
I mean, you would think that because teacher salaries in this country have been at the bottom end for a long, 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 long time. Yet,
long time.
The hierarchy of these federation and unions make good salaries, have great benefits, and et cetera. And so, at some point, I think it's appropriate to ask the question: do we unfortunately have a lack of toughness as it pertains to the heads of these teachers' federations going in and really fighting for greater compensation for their members?
Well, Mr. Everett, you know, I'm on the right. From what I've seen from the unions, if it was up to me, I'd shut them all down. The
mm-hmm.
state's budget, 3/4 of the state's budget is used for education. You have hundreds of collective impact organizations, Education Minnesota, Generation Next, Northside Achievement Zone, NAS, all these little slot organizations for the last 10 years that say they do this and this and this, and they're doing all these reports about the achievement gap, black kids, Hispanic kids. You know, how many reports are we going to have to do, and how much money of that 3/4 of the state budget is going to have to go to these clowns before we figure out that's not the way to fix the problem? To answer your question, Mr. Edwards, no, we don't need any more money. The money's there, but administratively it is, you know, you have money flying to Massachusetts to Pearson's. They get millions of dollars. You should see these tech books. I've never seen anything like it. It's like, why would you teach a kid that? Why would you read out of this book to a kid? Why would a teacher want to teach a child this way? And so you have Pearson testing the teachers. You have Pearson deciding for the state if Hamline University did a good enough job of training this particular teacher. It's not Hamline University's opportunity to say that, okay, he had a 4.0 average or she had a 4.0 average, all during her master's training, his master's training. They showed a wonderful cognitivity.
Exemplary, yeah.
These
guys should be teachers. But we're kind of begging the question that I posed to you. Who do we ask and point the finger out and point the finger at, if you will, with regards to not being able to deal with increased compensation and decent salaries for teachers? I mean, is that the teacher's responsibility, or should we expect big white corporate America to take on that battle, or should the parents rebel? Of course, unfortunately, in black America, too many parents aren't even making close to what a teacher is being paid, be it $27,000 or $28,000 or $30,000 or whatever. So will we ever be able to up the salary of teachers and educators, particularly in the elementary and middle schools?
I think if they focus the money from the collective impact agencies, from Pearson's, and keep the money in the state, I think there's an opportunity for a first-year teacher to start out at $45,000 a year.
Okay.
I mean, the
all
money
right.
is there.
Yeah.
So,
all right, I'm getting
just
a couple text messages saying, hey, you guys going to update us on a couple of the issues that you've been talking about. Number
and we
one,
do have a call,
Kevin Quarles has been terminated at KMOJ. Freddie Bell is now the acting station manager. By the way, they're having a Freddie Bell party tomorrow at Arnella's in St. Paul. Is there some controversy going on about that kind of arrangement, Don?
Well, actually, it's not a Freddie Bell party tomorrow. Tomorrow's party at Arnella's at 5 p.m. is to a networking event organized by the Council for Minnesota's on African Heritage by the board chairman, Ms. Doris Baylor, to celebrate the appointment of Dr. Lewis Porter as the executive director. That's
well, wait,
what's
now,
going
wait,
on there tomorrow.
Wait. Now, so how did Freddie Bell's name show up in some of the communications as being the person that had negotiated the Thursday night outing, or is it Freddie Bell and KMOJ's annual outing?
From what I have seen, Mr. Edwards, this is a contract negotiated by Freddie Bell over a couple of weeks ago as the station manager of KMOJ, has the negotiating leg, taking Kevin Quarles' place, to put into place every fourth Thursday of the month, like kind of like a last Thursday kind of event, and the council is supposed to have this networking event on a regular basis. I understand that there's being some funds switched hands for this. I'm still kind of, keying in on some stuff, and I probably will have an update next week because I do plan on going to the beginning of this event because I'm working in St. Paul tomorrow. And, I don't understand it. I mean, I think I like Dr. Porter. I like what he's getting ready to do, but I don't think that being in any nightclub, I understand supporting a black business, that's great. But does the Council of Black Minnesotans have to, or the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, have to be at a nightclub to show their community connection? I mean, what happens?
What's the legal consequences of that kind of arrangement?
Well,
a state agency
having
a night out at a local privately owned club in any city, Minneapolis or St. Paul.
I without having the documentation in front of me, I can speak on this and say that I think there's an ethical issue in there. There's also a liability issue in there because that someone comes, Mr. Edwards, and has a little bit too much Glenlivet Scotch and drives home and kills himself or herself, just leaving this event at Arnella's and the council, networking event. It can get really sticky. It's a slippery slope. I'll put it like that.
Okay. All right. I'm just kind of wondering about it, particularly in light of what happened to Kevin Quarles and another staff member of KMLJ. And I guess there was supposed to be some kind of meeting with the board of KMLJ indicated to the Urban League, Mr. Belton, and some others that meeting, board meeting, which I think was supposed to take place tonight, was canceled. And then there was an attempt to have a meeting this past Monday, to talk in terms of the status of Mr. Quarles. That was canceled. And meanwhile, Mr. Quarles was formally fired after being suspended for 30 days. I was just kind of wondering what the take of the community is. But I guess KMLJ is financially firm. Why, you got a caller? We got a caller?
Yes, we have a caller.
Oh, go ahead. Let's put him on.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, gentlemen. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yes.
Em, how are you doing, my friend?
Very good. Very, very good. Another riveting program. But I, in listening to some of your recent comments here, I did have a question. What is this group called, the Council on African American Heritage? Is this another type of quasi?
No, this is the name change of the Council on Black Minnesotans.
The name was changed.
To be more inclusive, whatever that's supposed to mean, both African Americans and Africans, if you will. I'm not understanding why the continent Africans weren't given their own council. You know, the Nigerians, the Liberians, the Somalis, the Kenyans, and et cetera, could have all had their own council. I don't.
Okay, now I get it. So it's kind of like the old. When I was in school, I learned the different countries, now that all the countries are called different names, and I don't know what they're talking about, and I think that's kind of the purpose.
There you go.
I mean, I've never heard of the same school.
Got it. Yep, that's what it is. So the name change took place in the last 5 months or thereabouts. That was something the legislature left with the citizens of the state of Minnesota at the end of the 2015 legislative session, and then they just made the transition. So that's who they are. I think one conversation Mr. Allen and I had maybe, I don't know, 5 weeks ago, and when we had Dr. Porter, who is the new executive director, we kind of asked that question. People seem to be a little uneasy when you ask the question on what was the purpose, what is achieved by that, and what happened to the importance and the history of African Americans in Minnesota, but, you know, nobody seems to really want to deal with that. But what else?
Well, no, and then I did have another, you know, comment on some of the, you know, riveting comments, you know, from Mr. Allen about, you know, what's going on in our schools, and I guess, you know, having been brought up in this town and gone to schools and, you know, battled through those schools to get, you know, bachelor's degrees, graduate degrees, my brothers and sisters doing the same thing, my sister being a PhD professor with, you know, master's from Harvard, PhD from Columbia, and I think about
Northwestern. That's right.
The things I think about going to the schools at that time, and what it is, you know, they had an order. You know, when you come into the school, just like if you come into my house, okay, I'm in charge. Okay, you don't come in here clowning, okay? And it's a known thing, and that's how the schools were then. I mean, I transferred schools. I started at Adams, went to Phillips, but they had people there that were in charge of the school, and it was very clear that you were there for a purpose. And I think what seems to miss is that kids go there now with all these cell phones and all these tattoos.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the kids think they're grown now. And see, that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be grown until you've gone through the process. The process of life.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, it takes a whole lot to be a man. Okay?
Yeah.
Very simple statement, isn't it? Very simple.
Mm-hmm.
But it says a whole lot in just those few words, and that's kind of what's missing. You know, these kids, they see all these things on TV now, things that they would never allow me to watch when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't. If those things were on TV, they would never allow you to do those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the proliferation of things that we have, just example like gambling, for one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go out to these casinos, you see kids, they're carding them 17, 18, 19, starting on this cycle downward right away. All these things were considered vice.
Key word we don't use much anymore.
We don't use that anymore. Anything goes society now, and we're paying the price for that. We are paying the price for that. All along the line, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, I mean, in our families, everybody's paying the price for this anything goes mentality. I mean, a Donald Trump that can get up here and disparage people around the world, disparage women.
Let me end it, and if any of the callers are there, Mr. Allen, let us know. We can bring them in, two or three or four. I want to hear some of the observations from thinking people, such as yourself, Mr. M., Yesterday, of course, following the tragic bombing in Brussels. But by the way, we just had a week before that some tragic bombings in Turkey, if you will, a lot of brown people blown up and et cetera. But I don't remember that we flew the American flag at half staff, or we spent as much time as CNN and MSNBC and et cetera. But I guess there's a reason for that. But anyways, you know, there's a tragedy. 250 people are injured. There are at least probably 35, 36, 37. There are at least now 8 or 9 people who are missing, which means in a situation like that, they probably were blown apart. But Mr. Cruz and Mr. Trump have said they have an answer to how to deal with the Muslim problem. It's all of a sudden become the Muslim problem and the threat to the United States. And that is to send military forces into Muslim neighborhoods and began to round them up. Now, I haven't heard anything like that since this country rounded up the Japanese in January of 1942. seized all their properties, assets, and et cetera. And in fact, it took the Nishi Americans, as they were really referred to, over 35 years to even get hearings before the Congress. But what do you feel as a person of color, an African American, about people who are attempting to attain a position of significant power, president of the most powerful nation on the earth, who are saying that we need to deal with this Muslim problem, and we need now just to also take care of the gangs. I found that interesting last night to watch both Trump and Cruz some way or another tie in the black gangs of New York and Los Angeles, et cetera. But what is your comfort level as an American with regards to people of that powerful status making that kind of declaration?
Well, I mean, if this is addressed to me, yeah, I mean, I think it's frightening. I mean, I think it really is. I mean, you know, the Muslim religion is just as legitimate as the Christian religion, okay?
All right,
I mean, it has a longer history. It has a longer, and so we're all trying to seek, you know, the God, and logic would tell you that there's not 4, 5, 6, 7. That there more than likely there would be one, and if we're all looking for the same thing, there's no reason that we can't bound together. But divisiveness seems to be the plan. Divisiveness seems to be the way to kind of keep, you know, pockets here, so that there's not a cohesiveness in our society. So, yeah, I listen to the rhetoric of Trump, and, I mean, and it's appalling to me.
Cruz,
it really is. I mean, I don't think that they have the diplomacy. I don't think he has the diplomacy. Now, maybe he's putting on an act. I don't know. That's what some
people. Oh, he's a great actor, and I say that in my column.
He's a salesman.
He's a great actor.
There's no question about that. He can get on there, and he can just espouse forever. But, you know, does he have the real acumen? If he becomes president, he's president for everybody. He's not just president for – he's president for you. He's president for me. He's president for everybody in this country.
That's right. Let me ask
from
this
what
question.
I've
Mr.
seen,
Allen,
I don't see that he has the wherewithal to really, you know,
right,
embrace all the different issues that would need to be embraced. So
let me do this. I want to keep you with it. Ask my co-host, Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen, we indicated we were going to talk about this in our production. What was your take? I mean, you are a person who has been a defender of this nation. You were in the military and et cetera. You served your country with loyalty and et cetera. How did you feel when you became aware of the statements by these two Republicans yesterday?
Oh, well, I think Cruz can go to hell. Donald Trump, though, Mr. Edwards, I'm going to tell you this and just put it plain and simple. I still like him. I like what he's saying, except he needs a better filter. I think he's a good entertainer. And I think the media is the main thing playing him up. The media has wanted a individual, Republican or Democrat, that they could put in the White House since Reagan. And they have that opportunity right now with Donald Trump because he's got
billions. In other words, Ronald Reagan, who was a great movie actor, right?
A movie actor, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And so now you have this guy,
Trump, who, I mean, some of his rhetoric is absolutely stunning, and I sit there with my mouth open. But he's even said that I can go on Fifth Avenue and shoot some people, and I'll still be popular the next day. You know, he said things like that. And I'm like, and it holds to be true. He hasn't told a lie about that at all. So I'm looking at this from a point of view, I can't really at this point look at it from being a Republican or being an independent conservative. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it from a social political standpoint and an entertainment standpoint, because I think he can be a president. But I think he needs to work on his filters, number one. Number two, the people advising him, you know, when you have someone as boisterous as he is, you don't listen to the people around you. You barely listen to the people around you. And he's going to have to put a cap on that, because diplomacy is important. But at this point, this is one of the most exciting presidential election cycles ever. But and another unique thing that I want to add in there, Mr. Edwards, is that I'm really sitting back and laughing at the Republican establishment. Do you know right here in this town, Stanley Hubbard sent $10,000 to an organization, to a group of Republicans trying to figure out how to derail Donald Trump. On Sunday, the Star and Tribune, front page above the fold, 100 days to stop Trump. Okay, how about 100 days to stop poverty, 100 days to stop unemployment? Okay, why don't we look at something like that instead of playing into the sensationalism of this person that's stringing them along like puppets at this point? So with that said, I think that we have other things to focus on. And, yeah, Trump is out there. He's running. He's the most popular. He's not only getting Republican votes. He's getting independent, undecided. Democrat, Green, a lot of people who are fed up. That's how you go in and you win Utah. So,
well, of course, in Utah, he made the mistake of calling Mitt Romney a non-Mormon, and that's the death nail in Utah. You could see by the votes. I think if I'm not mistaken, he acquired only 17% of the vote. Cruz just cleaned his clock. Now, that's consistent what Mr. Allen said just seconds ago. His advisors should have told him but he's a person who speaks off the cuff, so there was no one had any inkling that he was getting ready to make a statement about Mitt Romney's religion, particularly when Trump was getting ready to have a election in the state of Utah. If there's any state in the United States that you don't talk about the Mormons and Brother Smith,
I do have a question, gentlemen. I know I don't want to take up all your time, but
go right ahead.
I do have a question, you know, in regards to the election. I know that you know, Mr. Allen seems to be a staunch Trump supporter.
Oh, he's on the right. He's Mr. That's why him out. My associate on the right.
He's also.
But go ahead. What's your question, Em? I'm sorry.
Well, he's also been referred to as Rochester at one point. But my question is, what do you think is the position of Black America in regards to Donald Trump? And I guess I want to just kind of. Well, I just want one more addition to that, the position of Black America and Mexican Americans. What do you think conversion to the Trump message?
Well, let me say right off the bat, because I saw something last week, a African American sister from Los Angeles, she called herself a confidant of Donald Trump, which is kind of interesting. She had, you know, the long flowing hair and et cetera. You know, and a very nice looking sister, probably about in her early 40s. I wasn't surprised, because I came up during a period, as I think you did also, Em, when we had Black folk who were finding some kind of way to support George Wallace. I came up also at a time when I saw people supporting, and this is something the white media, the white fourth estate, does not like to talk about in this country. And Mr. Allen, this would be just a tad before your time. You still was a little kid. But Barry Goldwater. Now, I now equate the campaign, this campaign of 2016, with the campaign of 1964. when Barry Goldwater almost tore this country apart, he and his supporters, because they were deaf on the civil rights legislation that was pending. And it was interesting that it was a good old Southerner from the deep bowels of Texas, Lyndon Baines Johnson, that actually pushed that legislation through. But I can well remember Negroes, maybe not any more than 2 or 3% or et cetera, but I can remember them justifying that George Wallace was a good man and et cetera. And I'm seeing that now with Trump. I'm seeing a rather interesting group of African Americans who say that Donald Trump speaks the gospel.
Tomming is also has always been a good sidelight for certain people. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's hitting it too
okay,
much.
Okay, let me
speak.
Go ahead,
Mr.
Allen.
Go ahead. Do this. No, you can beat up on me. I can take a thick skin. But anyway, here goes the thing. If I choose, or black people choose, to support Donald Trump in the public sphere, there should be rhetoric between those supporters and those that do not support. I don't think there should be, like, let's go back to Abraham Lincoln time. There were people that didn't.
Now, you know, we all loved Abraham Lincoln.
So, I mean, there was a time in the public sphere where you could have these conversations, and there wouldn't be any name calling. There wouldn't be, you know, there you could go back and forth, and then at 5 o'clock you go sit down and have a beer together. You know?
Okay.
And so, so what I'm saying is that, yeah, Donald Trump is out there. There are some black hardcore supporters. I've seen the video. I haven't went that far yet, and I'm looking at him, and I'm asking why. You know, I'm curious. Are they supporting Donald Trump for the same reason I'm supporting Donald Trump? And what I'm finding out after not talking to them but watching their video is that they're upset for some of the same reasons that the rest of America is upset. And so the thing is, Trump is pulling at the heartstrings of those people that are pissed off on the way the government, fair tax. There's no fair tax. There's things going on where, you know, you get your paycheck and it's gone before you even get to the bank. The fees are too high. There's nothing that has been repealed. And we continue to go on this upscale gas. It's teetering now between $1.99 and $2.07. Okay, why hasn't it been there all along? No one's dealing with the airlines industries. We know that, around 2008 they said that we need to have these baggage fees because the gas is really expensive for our airplanes, jet fuel. Now the gas has gone down over the last 2 years. The petrol has gone down the last 2 years to be extremely cheaper than it was, way cheaper than it was before the crisis even happened. And the airlines are still clocking $9 million a month plus in profit, and no one's addressing that. You know, no one's saying anything.
Well,
so
now we
have to
say, in all fairness, that that's under the Obama administration. And now, from the left, I have to say that Obama has to be, in his administration, his Secretary of Transportation, and people like that have to have a responsibility to have done with that. And particularly 2 years ago, when we had a Democratic-controlled Congress, both House and Senate, they should have been dealing with that. But then maybe that's something that Mr. Lawrence, who was on earlier with us, who's going to run against incumbent Senator Bobby Joe Champion, was kind of pointing out and elaborating on to some degree. Inconsistency. And I'm sorry, go right ahead, Em.
Well, no, I'd like to say that, you know, I agree with everything that Mr. Allen just said. I really do. I agree with everything he said. But I just don't believe that Donald Trump is the man to implement these things. I don't think he has any time for a poor person, okay? I don't think he has 1 minute of time for somebody that doesn't have money.
I think he basically
is a businessman type. And, yeah, he's good at what he does. But I just don't see that he's someone that, you know, can empathize with people that, you know, a system of welfare that has perpetrated this thing for millions of black people for years and years to figure a way to get out of that. I don't think he'll have any time for people like that.
I concur on that. Mr. Allen, I'd kind of like to hear your observation. I just don't think that Donald, on that particular situation, has both the interest and certainly is not going to make for the energy. And one of the things that I think is happening, Mr. Allen, and I saw it with Ben Carson. I mean, I like Ben Carson. He's a great surgeon and physician and man of medicine. But I kind of got the feeling when he endorsed the Donald that he was looking to be appointed to a cabinet position, probably health and human services.
Yes, Tommy. Surgeon General. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tommy.
Yeah.
Let me.
Yeah. No, not Attorney General. You mean Surgeon General? Yeah.
Surgeon General is what I said. Yeah, Surgeon General.
Yeah, he couldn't be Attorney General because he doesn't have a law degree. Congress would never confirm you, and you ain't got you don't have any legal education. But I just thought that Ben, as I watched Ben, I said, oh yeah, Ben is maneuvering for that one African American Negro that would be in President Trump's cabinet.
Here's what I think, Mr. Edwards.
No, Herman Cain has that job, but he locked up.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Here's what I think what's going to happen. We sit here locally and we complain about MnDOT, Met Council, the Minnesota Department of Administration, the Civil Rights Departments on both sides. And, yeah, I think you're right. I think that Trump is not going to really care. He's not going to go too many tiers down to deal with a problem. I agree with that 100%. But one thing I do think, if you lay the facts in front of him, if you say, President Trump, here's what's happening, and you have LaHood or whoever he has for the Department of Labor sitting at the table, a couple other folks, attorney general sitting at the table, and you say, hey, this is what's going on in Minnesota. They have $400 million a year. None of these groups of people are hired. Matter of fact, they gave one contractor in Minnesota like $1,000 out of $400 million.
Yeah.
I think he would be appalled, and he would say, hey, wait a minute. That's not how it's supposed to work. Someone is breaking the law. And I think he would go to address that, because if you fix the problem that way, that will trickle down to where it needs to go. The unemployment in 55411 will not be 40%. If Met Council, MnDOT, the Department of Civil Rights enforced compliance, and these other folks did what they were supposed to do. So that's my take on it.
Okay. Now, you got to understand, Em, that Mr. Allen is speaking from the right. But I'm not going to be critical. I'm going to be fair-minded. What he says, I can identify with it and et cetera, but I'm like you. I just don't think that the Donald is the man to do it, nor is Ted Cruz. Definitely not. Ted seemed to have forgotten that his daddy fled to a place called Canada from Cuba, and yet his son is now talking about sending military troops into Muslim neighborhoods and communities in the United States to, quote-unquote, bring order. And how quickly we forget. But
overall, our choices are just slim. I mean, I think
if not none, if you will. By the way, quickly, and as long as we have you with us, because you periodically have asked about it, you asked about it last week. The word is, of course, in about 6 days, the powerful county attorney will make his determination. See, everybody's gotten quiet about Jamar Clark. And the county attorney will be making a decision. Now, I'm saying it here on the Don and Ron show. The word out of the big county building is that he is not going to charge. Now, I don't know what that's going to do, gentlemen, for those who have been patting themselves on the back that they got the county attorney to abandon the grand jury process. I want to continue to remind our listening audience that there is a grand jury process that will be implemented, and it is the federal government, which is required by federal law in a matter such as this, which they are still investigating, by the way, to take it before a grand jury. So I just kind of want to remind some of the folks out there, because I've been seeing some people such as Mel Reeves and others who have gone to great lengths to proclaim victory, and I'm not understanding what victory they're...
Careful what you ask for.
Definitely careful what you ask for. So I'm just trying to figure out what will be the response. Now, I saw some action at the legislature, and I know that Mr. Allen's friends and associates in that Republican Party were ticked yesterday. You could tell it by the expression on their face. and they voted the bill right out of committee, right to the floor of the House. And then the folks went over and tore up the St. Paul Board of Education meeting. So I guess folks are getting ready to respond when Big Mike decides that the police officers will not be charged.
Well, if that happens, I want to ask you one question. You know, since you're very knowledgeable about the inner workings of these things, and I really appreciate you enlightening the community about that.
Thank you.
But if, in fact, you know, the grand poobah says, you know, he's not going to charge them, will he be able to say why he's not going to charge them? Will he be able to say there's no evidence to support charging?
Yes,
other than to say no charging will be coming?
Yes, I think that he will, and we have about 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes left. I think that he wants to, and he has set the trap and set the stage to be able to indicate why he has made that decision not to charge. And the finger is going to be pointed at us in the African-American community because we did not come forward with the evidence. See, I heard a lot of people
talking.
On the
police grounds. I mean, isn't there video that they have some video. They have
no,
something.
No, we spoke on this before.
Come on.
Now, they do not have what a jury would need. In fact, if the issue was brought before a judge, I've said this to our listening audience before, and you've raised the question a couple of times. There is no video of the final moments of the life of Jamar Clark.
Then it's been squashed. If there's no video, it's been squashed.
There never was any video. There really never was. The ambulance was not positioned that its camera would have caught anything.
Did the governor look at?
The governor looked at some video from a camera which is positioned just on the corner. It actually is part of a cell tower that is there. Okay, that's the video he looked at. Okay, and then there's a camera a little bit further down the street. Those are the cameras that the governor looked at. As he said, they were absolutely inconclusive. Those were the videos. See, a lot was made of the videos when everyone knew that they're really was not a significant number of videos. But what happened
Mr. Edwards, I mean, every TV show you look at, everything you say, these lawyers always say, you never know what a jury will do. Okay? You never know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's inconclusive to the governor, but maybe it's not inconclusive to a jury. I don't know. But it just seems to be a big squash.
Well, yeah, it is, because people said that they had videos and they were present and they witnessed the death of Mr. Clark, and it just wasn't true.
Bring them in. Bring the witnesses in. Let's have it out and see. But, you know, I mean,
let me impart this back to you this way. Where are the witnesses?
Stand by.
The NAACP should have done was to have presented the list of witnesses that they said they had. One of the things that's coming out of the county attorney's office is that no such evidence was ever presented to them.
There was all kinds of people on that street that night. Okay?
That's messed up, G.
G?
Okay.
I'm afraid there may have been some people around, but there were far too many people in the party in the house where the incident got started. But anyways, time will tell. We got about 6 days, and the big boo-boo, the big guru, will make his announcement. I'm one of those that is certainly waiting on it.
Okay, caller.
All right, Em, thank you, man. All right.
Stand by.
Take care.
Caller, you have 10 seconds.
Great program. Phone lines, of course, will be open again next Wednesday. Oh, by the way, but next Wednesday will be 2 days away from the decision by the county attorney here in Hennepin County.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like a plan.
James Brown, take us home.
Okay, we're going to find her. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, the same bat time, same place.
All right.
And James, where are you?
Find him. James Brown.
He's walking.